ॐ भद्रं कर्णेभिश्शृणुयामदेवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैः स्तुष्टुवागंसस्तनूभिः व्यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति नहिन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्ष्यो हरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः.
Very good. Welcome back. Back up here.
Because today we begin the study, our study of the Mandukya Upanishad. In this sequence of classes on Tuesday nights, we've chosen to do short Upanishads. We've started with the Isha Upanishad. We've just concluded our study of the Kaivalya Upanishad. And the next Upanishad for our study is called the Mandukya Upanishad. It comes from the Atharva Veda, as did the Kaivalya Upanishad, which is why the opening prayer is the same. For Upanishads drawn from the Atharva Veda, the prayer Bhadram Karnebihi is a prayer that's traditionally done for all Upanishads that happen to come from the Atharva Veda. And I guess we'll start with an introduction to the Upanishad and then begin with the first verse. I should mention that the slides that we're using along with my translation is available on our website. You can print out a copy for yourself. Or if you have another text, you can bring that and use that. We begin with the name, which is a little odd. If you know some Sanskrit, it sounds very odd because Manduka is a frog. Mandukya is that which comes from a frog. This is an Upanishad that comes from a frog? Absolutely not. So another meaning, another derivation for the word Mandukya is what comes from Manduki. Could be Manduka or Manduki. Turns out that Manduki is the name of a famous rishi. So Mandukya is that which comes from Manduki. The Upanishad, which was drawn from the teachings of an ancient rishi called Manduki, is the Mandukya Upanishad. So if you see any connection between this Upanishad and frog, you know that somebody knows a little bit of Sanskrit, and as they say, a little bit of knowledge is dangerous. All right. let me go to the board and give some more detailed introduction. Thank you. So just to put the Mandukya Upanishad in context, there are a series of 10 Upanishads which we happen to study much more than other Upanishads because they deal with the subject matter of Advaita Vedanta and they have been commented upon by Sri Shankaracharya, who is the foremost of the teachers of Advaita Vedanta. So these 10 Upanishads are central. Of the 10 Upanishads, we've already studied the Isha Upanishad. Kaivalya Upanishad is not one of this list of 10. We included it, however, because, well, it met two requirements. One, it was short. Some Upanishads would take us a year or more to study. So the Kaivalya Upanishad was short. But secondly, it deals with Advaita Vedanta in a very beautiful and profound way. And that's what we saw during our study. So even though the Kaivalya isn't one of these 10, we included it because of its focus on Advaita Vedanta. This Mandukya is one of the 10 commented upon by Sri Shankaracharya. But there's a few other things about it that we should know. One is, of these 10 Upanishads, it's the shortest. And short means short. There are only 12 verses in this Upanishad. Yet, in spite of its brevity, it ends up being one of the most important of the 10. Now, that's kind of counterintuitive. You'd think that the really big, massive Upanishads, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, the Chandogya Upanishad, which run to hundreds and hundreds of verses, you would think that there'd be more emphasis on them. Turns out that this Mandukya is considered by most scholars of Vedanta as, I can't say most important, but they would say most powerful. A term has been used to call this Muktika Upanishad. Muktika Upanishad, there happens to be another Upanishad with that name. But they call this Upanishad that same name, meaning it's the Upanishad that can grant mukti, moksha. This Upanishad in and of itself is considered so powerful that this is the only Upanishad you need study. And there may be some truth to that. If you were going to pick one of the 10 to study, not just to study, but to really assimilate, to get it, as we say in English. If you just study and study and study and study, we'll all grow old without growing any wiser. But if you were to take this very brief 12-verse Upanishad and not merely study it, but really get it, as we say in English, really assimilate the truth taught by this Rishi Manduki, then nothing else would be required. This Upanishad is in such high regard that it drew a number of important commentaries written upon it. So the Upanishad, being part of the Atharva Veda, is ancient. How ancient? It's hard to put a date on it, but ancient begins perhaps at a couple thousand years old, maybe. But then there is on this Upanishad, there is a commentary, a verse commentary by one Gaudapada. This commentary by Gaudapada. Gaudapada, by the way, was Shankaracharya's teacher's teacher, his Paramaguru. So if Shankaracharya lived approximately 1,200 years ago, then this Gaudapada might have lived maybe 1,300 years ago, just in some rough numbers. He wrote on this Upanishad a commentary in the form of verses. A commentary in the form of verses is called a karika. This is just to give you some of the kind of academic background, just to put this Upanishad in context. So Gaudapada's karika is one of the most important texts in all of Advaita Vedanta. It's a big study. There are about 200 verses in it, and it's really heavy. The first section is not too bad. The first section is basically a commentary on the Upanishad. So the verses of the first section of the Karika are commentary on this Upanishad. But then there are three more sections. These three sections get very, very technical, and a lot of it is interesting to observe. A lot of it is devoted to refuting Buddhist thought, which was in vogue at that time. You all know that Buddhism had its roots in India, and by Buddha lived maybe around 500 BCE, and by about 200 BCE, it spread throughout India and became the prevalent religion for a period of time. Buddhism was the prevalent religion through much of India, but then Gaudapada was part of a movement to bring India back to the Vedas, back to the Upanishads. Buddha rejected the Vedas, rejected the Upanishads, rejected all the, what we, I can't even say Hindu. At Buddha's time, there was no Hinduism and Buddhism. Those terms were not used at all in Buddha's time. So it was all dharma. It was all religion or religious or spiritual teachings. But what the Buddha taught rejected the Vedas, including the Upanishads. And then by Gaudapada's time, there was a movement to come back to the Vedas, to come back to the Upanishads. So Gaudapada was one of the foremost in that movement. And then, so these three sections deal a lot then with refuting Buddhism and other things. In other words, very scholarly, very technical, scholarly. And not only is that scholarly, but on each of these sections, Shankara then wrote a commentary. Shankara writes a commentary on each one of these four sections of Gaudapada's Karika. And then on Shankara's commentary, there are at least three major sub-commentaries called tikas. And in a scholarly tradition, this is all studied with great intensity. You can imagine that a thorough study would take, of course, thorough study would mean daily classes, not weekly classes, and daily classes going on for certainly a year or more of daily classes, really, to make your way through all of this material. The point I'm trying to make is an ordinary Upanishad would never have drawn so much attention, scholarly attention. This Upanishad was considered so powerful, so important, that Gaudapada devoted himself to this major text, this Karika. Shankara devoted himself to commentary and many other sub-commentators later. So it's certainly an important text, not only because, here's the point. In spite of its brevity, it drew all of this attention. There's another reason it's considered very important, and that is its subject matter. Its subject matter is must be fairly brief. If it's a subject matter that can be described in 12 verses, it can't be a very extensive subject matter. Must be a very small subject matter. It is. In fact, the subject matter is one syllable long. What is that syllable? Om. That's right. So the Mandukya Upanishad is an exposition of the syllable Om. And we're going to see that in a very profound way in just a few minutes. Let me see if there's anything else by way of introduction here. Oh, that looks good. Okay. So I think we can then proceed to the first of the 12 verses. Just because it's short, don't think we're going to go through it very quickly. It probably won't be very quickly. But then we're not in any hurry. So let us begin. As we go through this, obviously, we can't study all of this, you know, the 200 verses of Karika and Shankara's commentary and the sub-commentaries. I will, however, be referring to some of it, in particular Shankara's commentary. He has some very profound comments that I'll introduce into the class. But mostly we'll stay focused on the actual Upanishad. So let's begin. Om ityetadaksharam. Om ityetadaksharam iram sarvam tasyopavyakhyanam bhutam bhavat bhavishyadati sarvam homkara heva sarvam homkara heva yat chan yat trikala titam tadap yongkara heva There are no suttas associated with this text, so it's permissible to use any simple melody for chanting, and that's just the convention in chanting and recitation. So, it begins, not surprisingly, Om. Om Iti. Iti puts Om in quotation marks, so to speak. Om Iti. Etat Aksharam. Etat, this Aksharam. This syllable. Etat Aksharam. Idam Sarvam. This syllable is Idam, this Sarvam. All this. Om is all this. Om is all this? I thought Om is Om. So we need to understand what is Om. And we're going to do so in a somewhat technical manner because this is a very important text. Let's understand Om as it's understood. This is what the commentators will get into so that we really understand the significance of that Om. It's chanted, recited, spoken of so much in the Hindu tradition, we may lose sight of its importance. To explore that, there are actually, surprisingly, three different ways of understanding Om. Three different ways. Let's see that. First off, Om is a, the Sanskrit word is Abhidhana. Abhidhana means name. So first off, Om. It doesn't look right like that. So Om. Om, or even better. Om is Abhidhana, a name. A name for what? Better be a name for something. For every Abhidhana, there is an Abhidheya, that which is named, that which the name represents. In this case, the Abhidheya happens to be Brahman. So, the first of our three ways of understanding Om, Om is an Abhidhana, a name for Brahman. We're going to come back to it because that's the primary use in this verse, not in the text, in the verse. The text will actually use all three meanings, but in this verse, the primary usage right now is as Abhidhana. We'll come back to that in just a moment. Just to see the other two ways of understanding Om, or the other two meanings, can't say meanings, the other two categories in which we understand Om. Om is also a pratika. Pratika means a symbol. And this we've actually seen before in the prior classes, where we've decomposed Om into the syllables A, U, and Ma, and the silence that follows. This is a symbolic interpretation of Om. When we break it up into these components, we're going to see that used once again in this text. In a very profound way. So Om is an Abhidhana, a name for Brahman. Om is a pratika, a symbol, often represented as Ahuma. And then a final usage, Om is an Alambana. Alambana is a technical term for object of meditation. That upon, Alambana means that upon which something hangs. So that upon which your meditation hangs or depends, the basis for your meditation is the alambana. So om becomes an object for meditation if you're meditating on om, 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 silently, of course. Then that usage of om is as an alambana, as an object of meditation. All three of these categories are relevant to our text, but we really begin with the first one. Oops. And I want to share with you something a little surprising that comes right at the beginning of Sri Shankara's commentary on this verse. And I'm not going to bore you with lots of commentary because it goes on and on and on and on, but just a few passages here and there. So Shankara here, in introducing this verse, he says, Yadidam artajatam abhidheyabhutam. He says, these things, yadidam, this thing which is artajatam, which gives meaning, which is abhidheya bhutam, these objects which are named, so these things in the world which are abhidheya bhutam, which are named, referred to as names, tasya abhidhana avyatirektat, avyatirekat, tasya abhidhana avyatirekat, tasya, from that thing that is named, abhidhana avyatirekat, it is non-separate from the name. Let me just paraphrase that just to make it very clear what Sri Shankara is saying, that whatever is named is non-separate from the name. Whatever is named is non-separate from the name. Whatever is named is non-different from the name. And that should sound a little strange. That should sound quite strange. What he's saying is that the abhidhana and the abhidheya are the same. The name and the named are the same. Let's explore that. Because Shankara starts his commentary with that, and if you understand what he's saying, it sounds a little strange, because what he's saying is, if you have an abhidhana, a name, like sugar, and the abhidheya is that which you pour into your tea. So the word abhidhana and that which you pour into your tea, are they the same? Do you pour the name sugar into your tea? You don't pour the name sugar into your tea, because we understand that the name and the named are different. The word sugar and the sweet substance are different. That's not what Shankaracharya says. He says avyatireka. He says they're non-different. They're non-separate. How can that be? He's saying that the name sugar is like the thing sugar. He's saying it's non-different, non-separate. Of course, Sri Shankara is not talking about sugar. If he were, he would use the word chakra. And this is a difference, actually, between languages. In the English language, we consider our words as arbitrary symbols that represent various objects. So why do we call that white substance sugar? We just all agree to call it sugar. If we were in North India, we would say chini. And then we'd all agree, okay, we'll call it chini. If you're here, you call it sugar. Wherever you go, you can call it different names in different places. These names are considered arbitrary designations for whatever we're naming. This is a conventional Western view of language. It's not the conventional view about the Sanskrit language. The traditional view about the Sanskrit language is that Sanskrit words are non-arbitrary representations of the things that they represent. That is, that it's the essential name. It's not an arbitrary name that we invent. It's a name that somehow is inherent in the very thing. Just to give you an idea of what that means, in English we have a few words that come close. For example, ma. That's not an arbitrary word. That's very fundamental. That's the sound every baby makes when their mouths are closed and then the mouth opens up. What sound comes out? Ma. And the mouth is closed around mother's breast. It opens. Ma. This is a non-arbitrary name. Ma is a fundamental name. Ma, the name Ma is essential to the person. It's not arbitrary. It's not symbolic. It's not invented or made up. Imagine a whole language having that nature, where the words are essential to the objects they represent, not arbitrary. Sanskrit is considered such a language. I can't prove it. I can't establish it. It's actually part of an ancient belief system. There's no way of proving it or establishing it. But it's important to know this is the ancient worldview. The ancient worldview is that the Sanskrit language is a non-arbitrary or essential designation for each word. And since that's so, then the Sanskrit word for sugar, shakra, is a non-arbitrary representation of the actual object. Again, don't ask me how. We could find an easy example with ma, maybe with pa, maybe with a few other words. Boom. In fact, the word bomb is a good example of that. Bomb is that which goes boom. So we have some words like that in English. So we can understand then Sanskrit being a language where all of the words are like that. Non-arbitrary, which means essential. So now apply that to Om. Om is the Abhidhana. It is the name. It's a name for the Avideya, which is Brahman. And recognizing this, that this non-arbitrary connection between Avidana and Avideya, then Om is Brahman. That's what Sri Shankara is saying here. Om is Brahman, not in a figurative sense, not in a symbolic sense, in a very literal sense, in the same sense as saying, in the same sense as saying sugar is chini. They're the one and the same thing. In that sense, Om is the reality called Brahman. Om is not an arbitrary symbol representing that Brahman. Maybe we take just a moment. We've done this long ago, but we might want to return to it at this point, just to show the natural connection between Om and Brahman. I could show that with the word Ma. We could see that easily with a word like Bam. With other words, with the word Chakra, I have no way of explaining how the word chakra would somehow inherently be the essential nature of sugar. I have no idea how that's so. But we do have a very clear idea about why Om is a name for Brahman and why Om represents Brahman in an essential way, not in an arbitrary way. Turns out that Om is a sound that encompasses all other sounds. It says, Om iti etat sarvam, idam sarvam. Om is all this. There is an all-encompassing nature implied to Om. So we could see it phonetically or in terms of sound if we can understand Om is a sound that encompasses all other sounds. In what way? When you begin saying Om, it starts down here, in the bottom of your vocal tract, in your belly. Om. And when you finish Om, at your lips. There's no sound deeper than There's no sound more forward than All the other sounds are in the vocal tract in between these two extremes. So om phonetically is the perfect sound to represent. It's an all-encompassing sound that represents the all-encompassing reality that we also call Brahman. Okay, so this is Om as the Abhidhana, as the name for Brahman, which is the Abhideya. But here in Sanskrit, we understand that the Abhideya, the named, is non-separate from the Abhidhana, the name. Okay, then we're going to talk much more about Om. The rest of the text is about Om in one way or the other. Om iti. Etadaksharam, this syllable called Om, is idam sarvam, all this. Just what do you mean by all this? One of the sub-commentaries, not Shankara's commentary, but a sub-commentary, defines all this in a very, very clear way. Vivikta pratiti gocharaha chara charatmakaha jagat. Very simple, beautiful Sanskrit. Vivikta pratiti gocharaha. That which appears variously and differently. Vivikta pratiti. That which appears variously and is gochara perceived. That which you perceive as being manifest variously. When we look around us, we see how many things, that sense. But not only that, that's the simple part. When we say Om, when we say Idam Sarvam, we say all this. That's the obvious meaning. All this means everything you see. But then he adds something else. Chara Charatmakam, that which includes Chara and Achara. Chara, things that move. Achara, things that don't move. So when we consider all this vivikta pratiti gochara, all these various things around us, we notice most of them don't move. Some of them do. You and me. So there are unmovable things. There are movable things. Those movable things are something unique about those movable things. Those movable things happen to be intelligent. In fact, those movable things are capable of perception. Some of those movable things are capable of thoughts and feelings. Not all of them. Insects and plants probably are not capable of thoughts and feelings. They are capable, perhaps, of perception. But these movable things that we call human beings are capable of perception, of thought, of feeling. In fact, they are conscious beings. Now, achara, that which doesn't move, this world around us, is a bunch of inert stuff. So the first thing we think about when we use that term, idam sarvam, I think I can erase this now. This is a little subtle point, but an important point, as you'll see. This expression, idam sarvam, all this, includes things that are achara. Literally, it means immobile, but we could say insentient. And things that are chara, movable, which we can say are sentient. So things that are achara, insentient, are just stuff, matter, physical stuff, elements. But things that are chara, of course, we have physical stuff here. There's also subtle stuff, inside. We're not going to talk about all the details of that. That's not our point right now. But in addition to the physical stuff, the sthula bhutas, of which our bodies are made, in addition to the subtle stuff, the sukshma bhutas, which enliven our physical bodies, we recognize that in these chara entities, in these sentient beings, there's something else that we loosely call consciousness. And we recognize that these elements of nature, physical stuff, and consciousness are two utterly different realms of existence. They are utterly unlike, and yet the term idam sarvam, all this, encompasses both. So go back. We said Om, which is a name for Brahman. Om is idam sarvam. Om is all this. Om then must definitely include elements and consciousness. Now you wonder, wait a minute. These are two utterly different things. How can Om include both? Or if we want to say Om is a name for Brahman, how can Brahman include both? And here we're going to need some of the very fundamental teachings of Vedanta. We need a lot of Vedanta to understand this. We've already studied a lot of Vedanta, so we're going to draw upon all that we've studied so far to make sense of this. This consciousness, we understand, is our, we can say, our individual consciousness, the true self, Satchidananda, Atma, the reality of who we are, Satchidananda Atma. But we've noted in many prior classes, at least a few prior classes, that the reality because of which we exist is a reality because of which everything else exists. The reality because of which we exist we call Satchidananda Atma. The reality because of which everything else exists, we call satyam, jnanam, anantam, brahma. It's a very important vakya from the Taittiriya Upanishad, satyam, jnanam, anantam, brahma. The reality because of which everything else exists. And these are not two different realities we're talking about here. These are one and the same reality. The reality because of which chara, sentient beings exist, is this Satchidananda Atma. The reality because of which all these elements, physical stuff exists, is Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma. Are we really talking about different things? Looks that way on the surface. But really speaking, one thing. This is Vedanta, where it looks different on the surface, but you go below the surface and you find the unity, the identity. Here's an interesting way of putting it. If we say, how did I put that? Yeah. So in this expression, idam sarvam, is Om. Idam sarvam seems to be different than Om because it seems to have two very different things, elements, physical stuff, and consciousness. How do we reconcile this? Well, these elements, as we've discussed before, are a manifestation of this underlying reality. Manifestation of underlying reality is like the pot being a manifestation of clay. These elements are like the pot. They're a manifestation of the underlying reality, which is Brahman. So coming back here, we can see that. To say that all this is Om is a little bit like saying the pot is clay. That's really what we're saying. The pot is clay. On the surface, they look very different. Elements are Brahman. On the surface, they look very different. But you go underneath, you recognize Brahman is a reality because of which the physical elements exist. We recognize that clay is the reality because of which the pot exists. They're not two different things. Or if we want to get very Vedantic, how about this? How's that one? Snake equals rope. Only a Vedantin can understand an equation like that, because you have to know the story of the snake in a dark alley that was actually nothing more than a rope, but the rope was not recognized, so a snake was projected. The snake is nothing but rope. The pot is nothing but clay. These elements are nothing but Brahman. So this statement, Om is all this, is a very profound statement of reality. It says that all that exists, sarvam idam, which includes both sentient things and insentient things, the most radically different categories we can imagine. If you think of categories, black and white are different, but they're both colors. Matter and energy are different, but they're both created. The most different categories you can imagine is consciousness and stuff. These are utterly different categories, and yet they're reconciled in this very opening phrase, Om iti etadaksharam. This syllable, Om, idam sarvam, encompasses all meaning sentient and insentient, and it's not a confusion when we recognize that the insentient, the physical stuff, is a manifestation of the underlying reality, which is sentient. Satyam jnanam anantam, sat chit ananda. These words are equivalent. Okay, enough. Come back to our text. Tasya upavyakhyanam. Tasya, of that Om. Upavyakhyanam. Vyakhyanam or upavyakhyanam is an exposition. This text is an exposition, tasya, of that, of Om. This entire text is an exposition of the syllable Om. A syllable Om, which is a name for Brahman, a syllable Om, which is idam sarvam, all this. And again, not figuratively, if we understand that Om is not an arbitrary sound or a symbol, but Om is an essential representation of Brahman, the reality because of which everything exists. Now, a little bit more about idam sarvam. Bhutam, all that was past, bhavat, that which is now, that which is existing in the present moment, and bhavishyat, that which will exist in the future. So bhutam refers to existence from the beginning of time, bhavat refers to all that exists right at this moment, and bhavishyat refers to all that will exist for the continuance of this cosmos. All of that, iti, thus, all of that, sarvam, all of that, omkaraha eva, all of that is the sound om, the letter om, eva, indeed, alone. All existence is om. How can we say that? We just finished with that. All that exists includes chara and achara. Includes the physical aspects of the universe, and will include with that the subtle aspects, so the stula and sukshma jagat, the physical and subtle universe. We include all of that here. All of that, including the consciousness, wherever it's manifest, all of that that existed in the past, in the present, in the future. Sarvam Omkaraha Eva, all of that is embraced by the syllable Om. Not only that, Yatcha Anyat, and in addition to that, what else is there? Past, present, future. And then he says, and also, you know, where is he also? And it's like if you have three coins on the table, and you say, these three coins also, you're only three coins. What else is there? It says, Trikala Atitam, Tad Api, that also, Omkaraha Eva, that also is Om. What also is Om? Trikala Atitam, that which is beyond these three periods of time. That's not used figuratively. This is actually a very definite, specific kind of instruction. That which is beyond the three periods of time, understand the universe as being cyclic. So the universe came into existence. What is it? 13.7 billion years ago. They've got a pretty specific number for that. So the universe came into existence 13.7 billion years ago. That is Bhutam, the past universe. All 13.7 billion years. Now we've got this moment, Bhavat, and then the future. However long the universe will exist, we don't know. Some billions and billions of years. All of that is included. Then there's something, Trikala Atitam, beyond these three periods of time, beyond this manifest universe, which means that which existed before the universe came into existence. That which preceded the existence of the universe, and that which will remain when this universe no longer exists. In Sanskrit, we have a technical word for it. It's called avyakrita. Avyakrita means that which is unmanifest. Vyakrita, manifest. Right now, vyakrita, the universe is manifest. Before the universe existed, the universe did not come from nothing. Nothing, this is just basic philosophy. This is like philosophy 101, Vedanta 101. Nothing comes from nothing. Something cannot come from nothing. Something can only come from a something. This universe is a something. It's not a nothing. Very simple. So this universe, which is a something, must have come from something. And in Vedantic terms, in Sanskrit terminology, this universe came from the unmanifest universe, which is to say, the unmanifest universe became manifest. Like the seed becomes a tree, the unmanifest universe becomes manifest. Like the tree dies and leaves a seed behind, the manifest universe becomes unmanifest. Manifest universe, vyakrita. Unmanifest universe, avyakrita. And notice how thorough this text is. When it says idam sarvam, it's not just talking about the universe and creation. The ancient rishis had minds that were such that they realized there's more than this manifest universe. There is such a thing as an unmanifest universe, and that's included here. Yat cha anyat, in addition to this manifest universe, past, present, and future, there is also trikala atitam, that which is beyond the three periods of time, which refers then to the unmanifest universe. Tad api omkaraha eva, that also is om. All right. Now, we will start the next verse. We definitely won't finish. All right, let's see this. Sarvam yetad brahma, sarvam yetad brahma, ayam hatma brahma, ayam hatma brahma, soyam atma chatushpat. Soyam hatma chatushpat. Sarvam hi etat brahma. Sarvam, everything, hi, indeed, etat, this, all this, indeed, is brahma. That's exactly the same as saying Om Om Iti Etat Sarvam. It's the same thing. You can say all this is Om. You can say all this is Brahman. They're identical statements, right? The first verse said all this is Om. The second verse begins Sarvam Hi Etat Brahma. All this is Brahman. Saying exactly the same. Nothing new is being said here. Why is it repeating itself? Why is the text repeating itself? It's preparing us for the next statement. I am Atma Brahma. I am this. Atma, this self, is Brahman. Have we heard that before? That's one of the four Mahavakyas. I am Atma Brahma is one of the four Mahavakyas. This is the source of that particular Mahavakya. Let's talk for, actually, we don't want to see too much of this class. Let's talk just a little bit about Mahavakya, and then we'll see how this one fits into the verse and text in the next class. But let's just reflect, what is a Mahavakya? This is one of four Mahavakyas. The rishis could only come up with four. That's all they could come up with. No way! There are probably hundreds of Mahavakyas. There are four that are specially selected. Four that are selected because of their simplicity and directness. And also, they're selected on a basis of one from each Veda. This is how this tradition goes. Let me just help you with that. So, the four Mahavakyas, you've heard this quoted again and again, four Mahavakyas, let's understand why. A Mahavakya is any statement that reveals the identity of Atma and Brahman. Any statement in any text that reveals the identity of Atma and Brahman, such a statement can be considered Mahavakya. Wherever it's found, even in Bhagavad Gita, we can find many. So let's see these. This one says, I am Atma. I am means this. This Atma is Brahman. Well, how obvious is that? So this is a Mahavakya that comes from the Mandukya Upanishad, which is part of the Atharva Veda. There are other Mahavakyas. Again, four that are quoted all the time. How about Prajnana, Prajnanam, Brahma. I am Atma Brahma. Prajnanam Brahma. Prajnanam means consciousness. Consciousness means my consciousness, your consciousness, this self that we are. Prajnanam refers to Satchidananda Atma. Prajnanam Brahma is the Mahavakya. This is found in the Aitreya Upanishad, which happens to be part of the Rig Veda. Then this one, you have to change the order. Tvam Tadasi. I'm just changing the order of the common Mahavakya so that it fits with our chart. Of course, the Mahavakya is Tat Tvam Asi. I'm just changing the order because Tvam refers to your true nature, Atma. Tat, the pronoun that, refers to Brahman. So Tvam Tat Asi follows that same pattern. This is the Mahavakya from the Chandogya Upanishad, which is part of the Sama Veda. And Aham Brahmasmi is Vriharanika? Yes, Yajurveda. Last of the four. Aham Brahmasmi, I, Brahma Asmi, I am Brahman. Here again, Aham, Atma, Brahma Asmi, I am that Brahman. This is the pattern of the Mahavakya. Any statement declaring the identity of Atma and Brahman, this comes from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is part of the Yajurveda. And as I said, there are many, many, many more than four Upanishads. The rishis weren't stuck on four. But as I said, these four are chosen because of their simplicity, their clarity, the power of their expression, and are also chosen specifically one from each Veda. Now, pretty amazing that this text includes this Mahavakya in the second verse. That gives you an idea of the kind of Upanishad we're starting when the epitome of the teachings of Vedanta is expressed in the second verse. Of course, it's not the last verse, so the other verses are going to go ahead and unfold how that is so. Let's just see, first of all, what's being said here, and then how we'll see in the next verse. What is being said is, I am Atma, the consciousness because of which you exist as a sentient being. That consciousness is Brahman, the reality because of which everything exists. The first time you hear this, it makes no sense whatsoever. But that's actually, maybe by now it is making some sense because of an expression I've been using again and again. The expression is this. Consciousness is the reality because of which you exist. The reality because of which you exist is not your personal possession. It's not something unique to you. It's not something that's yours. It's a fundamental reality, Satchidananda Atma, the reality because of which you exist. Since it's so fundamental, it's not just fundamental to you, it's fundamental to all, let's start with all conscious beings, which means that the consciousness by which your thoughts are known and the consciousness by which my thoughts are known are the same consciousness. We've gone over this in other classes. But now we can take it a step further. This is a fundamental reality we're talking about. How many fundamental realities do you think can exist in this universe? If it's really fundamental, you know, in science, we can get somewhat fundamental. Scientists can get down to two entities, matter and energy. Until Professor Einstein came along. I like the fact that he used to live just down the road. just down the road. And Professor Einstein helped us realize that matter and energy are two forms of the same thing, leading even science to come up with one fundamental reality because of which everything exists. Now, that's a purely scientific standpoint, but it points to a principle. The principle is fundamental reality cannot be plural. Fundamental reality must be singular. If Satchidananda Atma is a fundamental reality because of which you exist, because of which I exist, because of which every sentient being exists, that's one fundamental reality. But when we look at the stuff, the elements, the physical universe must also exist as a result of a fundamental reality. And as we just said, there can only be one fundamental reality. We are bridging a huge gulf. The gulf between the sentient and the insentient. The gulf between consciousness and physical stuff. This is a gulf that's reached or breached in this equation. By recognizing that the reality because of which you and I exist is the reality because of which the entire cosmos exists. That's the meaning of the Mahavakya. And when we use this kind of terminology, it's not so abstract anymore. And what we're hoping to accomplish in this class, using this wonderful Upanishad, is to make this a very vivid recognition for you. Of course, this presumes a lot of Vedantic study has already preceded this point. For example, to recognize that your true nature is Satchidananda Atma, independent of body, mind, and senses, that's a prerequisite for this Upanishad. That's not even touched in this Upanishad. We did get into it in other classes, but that's not even touched. That's presumed that you already understand that part. We will see, however, an analysis in the coming verses where Om is broken up into A, U, Ma, and the silent part once again, and applied to the body, mind, and senses, applied to experience, I should say. So we'll have another chance of getting that more clearly so that we can all make that connection and discover in a very simple, direct way that the reality because of which you exist is Satchidananda Atma, and that Satchidananda Atma is absolutely identical to the Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma, the reality of the universe. We'll see all that in coming classes. Oh, a quick announcement before our closing prayers. I forgot to mention this last week. We're at the time of year where weather can get bad, and our policy is when the roads are snow-covered or slippery, we will definitely cancel class. If you're not sure, there are days that are a little bit in between, so if you're not sure, you can check our website. On the home page, there'll be an announcement. If there's no announcement, class is normal. You can also phone the ashram, and you get option four. Option four is a recorded announcement. So either check our website or see our option four on the phone system if you're not sure about class cancellation. We'll conclude with our prayers.